Having read the paper from Demis at DeepMind, I was a big fan of his work and still remember the early days that they were trying to train reinforcement learning agents to play the game Pong as their first experiment. So I set about the same goal and I said, let's go train a whole bunch of neurons sitting on a multi-electrode array device to play the video game Pong.
Welcome to AI for Pharma Growth, the podcast from pioneering pharma artificial intelligence entrepreneur, Dr. Andre Bates. This show aims to demystify AI for all those in biopharma, from startup biotech right through to big pharma. Each episode focuses on all things AI and future tech related to help pharma execs to navigate through the and benefit from the sometimes confusing but magical world of AI-powered tools to grow and get real-world results.
Today's episode is, are we already at the point of human-computer hybrids and brain cell-powered computing? Software and synthetic biology, wetware, have resulted with in vitro biological neural systems. The most advanced of these neural systems elicit dynamic goal-directed behavior referred to as synthetic biology intelligence. Today, I'm with Hon Weng Chong, who's the founder and CEO of Cortical Labs. Human brain cells on computer chips trained these biocomputer hybrids to play the classic video game Pong. Hon is now turning the startup strategy into biological computers that he hopes will supercharge the growth of other companies. I'm so happy to have you on the show, Hon. I saw you at COGX last year and your work just blew me away. It's just so impressive. So I'd love to know a bit about your background and how you got into this space.
Thanks for inviting me on the show. I was at COGX last year and was talking about this stuff. So it's always great to follow up on, I guess, a very high level cursory sort of introduction of the technology. There's only so much you can really say in about a 20-minute presentation.
Yeah, of course. And where did your journey begin? What did you study and how did you end up here?
Yeah, so my background actually is in medicine. So I studied medicine at the University of Melbourne. I did the undergraduate degree. So I went straight from high school to med school, did about a six-year course, graduated in 2012. But it was a little bit of a, I guess, an oddball in a sense, because I really also love technology. And while I was in high school, I had taught myself how to program, you know, several programming languages, and I love tinkering around with hardware. And so when I was a first year medical student, I actually had a side gig where I was writing iPhone apps. That you know, gave me a little bit of pocket money, and that helped, you know, I guess, provide me with a bit of a booze budget when you're in medical school. So I kind of kept it going. And in my medical degree, there's a bit of a gap here in between the clinical and the preclinical years, mm-hmm. where the university encourages students to go overseas to do a year of research. Well, not necessarily overseas, but they encourage you to do some research. I was so fortunate that I was able to connect with my preceptor and still mentor today, Dr. Arun Matthews, who was a physician at Johns Hopkins, and also my other mentor, Professor Harold Lehman. So I had two mentors there. And he was interested in the use of video games as a non-pharmacological adjunct for the treatment of pain, depression, and anxiety in hospitalized kids. Mm-hmm. So that sounded like such a fun program. I applied and I, you know, was so glad that I was accepted. So off I went over to the US. I lived in Baltimore for about 12 months, did that research. But what was really interesting along the way was that my mentor, Dr. Reem Matthews, was also quite an entrepreneur himself and would regularly make trips to San Francisco to pitch his ideas and, you know, see if he could get any investment funding.
Yeah.
And so he was kind enough to say, hey, would you like to come to San Francisco with me? I'll cover your flights and you can, you know, just stay on the Airbnb couch. I was like, yeah, sure. So I was able to tag along and just, you know, get exposed to this whole startup ecosystem, which was kind of, you know, completely foreign to me, that All you had to do was come up with a really great idea, structure it in a way that made sense, and people would just give you money to do that. So that was my first exposure to it. I finished up that year. That was, I think, in 2010, during that research year. I went back to Melbourne to finish up my clinical training. And then in the final year of med school, I went back to Johns Hopkins to do my clinical elective in neonatology. Now, it was quite interesting because I had made quite a lot of friends at Hopkins. And one of the friends that I made was actually working for Microsoft. And that was how we were able to get the Xboxes donated for the research program. And he encouraged me to enter into a student competition called the Imagine Cup. So this was like my final year of medical school. And he said, well, you know, you're a very weird hybrid between a med student and also an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
If you could write some software, you know, that, or, you know, show how you could use technology to solve some of the world's toughest problems, you could be in the running for some pretty serious cash. And, you know, he incepted the idea, went back to Australia to finish off my final year of medical school. And I think just around that time, I was doing a unit in pediatric global health.
Mm-hmm.
And it was then that I had learned that childhood pneumonia was the single largest killer of children in the developing world. And that the treatment of it was actually quite simple, as long as you diagnosed it early, which was, you know, supportive oxygen or antibiotics in the case of bacterial pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it was recommended, and it still is actually today, to screen for pneumonia is respiratory rate. The issue was that in the developing world at that time, and in all places as well, still is a problem with limited technology, respiratory rate is actually very poorly done. There is very poor inter-observer reliability. So I came up with the idea, what if you could make a digital stethoscope that could help auscultate and then count the number of breaths that was taken by a child? And from there, you can figure out what the period is and therefore the respiratory rate. So I set about building a digital stethoscope that you could plug into your smartphone, entered into the competition, came up with a bit of a pitch and called StethoCloud, and was able to actually win the competition and got a $75,000 grant from Microsoft.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So this was way back, I guess, the start of, you know, the journey that I'm on right now. And this was in 2012. So I graduated med school in 2012, put that money into a research program, because we needed to collect the data in order to prove that, you know, you could actually do this using machine learning and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And did my internship, did a couple of months after that as an emergency medicine doctor. And along the way, my research nurse told me, hey, do you know I'm getting inquiries from parents about this stethoscope device that you built, asking how much does it cost and where can they buy this from? And that was quite, you know, intriguing to me, because I didn't think anyone would be interested in a prototype research device. And so spoke to one of the parents and asked why, what made him interested about this.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, you know, they live in, you know, far rural Victoria in a place called Madura, and it takes about 3 hours to get into Melbourne. And oftentimes it's only for a, you know, a checkup that would take about, say, 30 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And said it would be so great if they could just do it remotely, kind of thing. So this was, I guess, the start of, you know, telemedicine in 2013, 2014. So having heard about that, I decided to put my medical career on hold and convince a mate of mine who also participated in the Imagine Cup competition for him to put his career on hold as well, as a management consultant at Bain, pack our bags, and we went over to San Francisco with a prototype device, and we spoke to a whole bunch of people. And along the way, they said, hey, do you know there's this thing going on in Austin called South by Southwest, and you should go. So we looked at it and we're like, well, the flights aren't too expensive. The Airbnb was, but we were young and we were young and naive, and we're like, fine, you know, we'll sleep on someone's like floor. That's no big deal. So we did that, met a whole bunch of really great people, and was able to raise you know, some amount of money and brought it back home to Australia to then work on this whole thing. So this is, I guess, the first chapter of my story, which is that I had started a medtech company. I was the CTO, founder of that, called ClinicLab. Now, you might be thinking, how does this relate to the cortical lab story? Well, what happened was in 2016, so we had, you know, built a product, FDA approved, CE approved, and, you know, we were selling devices into Best Buy and like Amazon. We couldn't really grow to market. And this was pre-COVID. And so selling sort of medical devices was quite uncommon. So we tried to go into the employee health programs as a business thing. Grew a little bit, but not enough. Decided to put all our eggs in one basket and try to do the VA with a deal with a subsidiary from Intel. Now, that had been signed off. Unfortunately, however, this was in 2016, and regime change happened in D.C.
Yeah.
And Trump gets elected and decides to tear up Obamacare and replace it with an ambiguous Trump care. And so all the healthcare organizations, you know, including the VA, decided to freeze their discretionary expenditure budget.
Okay.
And we were one of the casualties of that. So, yeah. You know, by that time, we were down to our last. We had raised initially $5 million. We were down to less than $1 million left. And this was fatal for the company because we didn't have enough money to A, create a new product line, or B, make more devices. At the same time, we were burning cash trying to figure out what the hell was going on with, yeah, with the deal. And eventually in 2017, we decided it was no longer viable to keep the business going. And yeah, so I closed it. But around that same time, we had already started to gather quite a large database of breath sounds and also heart sounds. Mm-hmm. And we were doing machine learning analysis on these signals. So I was exposed to machine learning way back when I was in, a research fellow at Johns Hopkins, yeah, and have always been very interested by it. However, I didn't really want to do another convolutional neural net for X startup, which was the hot thing in 2017. It's the same thing as, yeah, like an LLM today.
Yeah.
So came across a really interesting article written by Demis Hassabis from DeepMind about the need for machine learning and AI researchers to return back to our roots in neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the initial discoveries were made because of neuroscience. And I did exactly that. In fact, I took that advice even more literally and spoke to the neuroscientists at the Florey Institute for Neuroscience at the University of Melbourne. And I said, what's exciting in your world? And they said, well, we have this device called the multi-electrode array, which allows us to read the electrical activity on the surface of the device where we plate neurons on, and the ability to also stimulate these neurons. And at that moment, when I heard that, I was thinking to myself, wait, you have the ability to read neural activity and stimulate that. And these neurons, if they were to grow large enough, would actually become a brain, which we know does compute and intelligence. Why hasn't anyone tried to get these neurons to perform compute and intelligence?
Yeah.
It seems kind of obvious. So
not to everyone.
Yeah. Well, it was just very, you know, deductive reasoning. So I said, all right, I'm going to try and do this. And in 2019, decided to form Cortical Labs to explore this idea. Mm-hmm. Can I, using a multi-electrode array device, train neurons to perform or learn to perform a task over time?
Yeah.
And, having read the paper from Demis at DeepMind, I was a big fan of his work and still remember the early days that they were trying to train reinforcement learning agents to play the game Pong as their first experiment. So I set about the same goal and I said, let's go train a whole bunch of neurons sitting on a multi-electrode array device to play the video game Pong. So that's how we all got started.
That's amazing. And how's it evolved since then? And what kind of difference have you had in the last 5 years?
It was a bumpy ride. So we started out in 2019. And I was, even to my surprise, that when I pitched the idea to an investor, the founder and partner at Blackbird Ventures, Nikki Skavag, that he actually gave me any money to do this. So I was able to raise a very small amount of money. I think it was about $1 million, which is about $670,000. Built a small lab, bought the equipment, hired a small team. And my intention then was to, you know, build on that and go out and raise more and, you know, get more fuel and momentum going. But then in 2020, COVID hits.
Yeah.
And we were in Melbourne and we did go through, I guess, the world's harshest lockdown. And so it was practically impossible for me to go around and meet people, raise capital, and so forth. Yeah. So looking at a situation, I said, we got to A, survive at all costs. Who knows how long this thing is going to go for. So we needed to lighten the ship and remove everything that we didn't need and trim the fat. So we did exactly that. We shrank down to a core team of four people, and we made it a sole objective of doing the hard science, because there wasn't anything else to do that during those years.
Yeah.
So we said, let's do the science. Let's perform a significant amount of rigor around experiments so that we can prove to even the most skeptical scientists that you could actually get neurons in a petri dish when given the right signals to be able to change their firing activity in order to affect a game ball of sorts.
Yeah.
That was what happened. We made that our sole focus, and it was a lot of mucking around and experimenting.
Yeah.
And we came across a really interesting idea developed by Professor Carl Friston at UCL called the free energy principle. And it looked so elegant. We said, it can't be the case that these neurons are all just trying to reduce the amount of information surprise, between their internal generative model and the observed world. Mm-hmm. Right? It seems so simple. But then again, that's what's been predicted by the theory and the principle.
Yeah.
So having learned about that theory, we realized that we could actually implement that in the training of our system without even needing to go down the path of dopaminergic, say, reinforcement, right? Your typical way of strengthening synaptic connections and so forth. So we went about that, and Andy, my co-founder and CTO, was quite brilliant, along with Brett, my CSO, at coming up with this idea that if neurons have an internal model of what the world is, and we really can't change that, we don't really have the ability to change the synaptic weights like you can do with an artificial neural network, and neither do you actually really do it manually in an artificial neural network. And there's this Markovian blanket that separates the internal distribution and the external world, which is, what we observe in reality, so to speak.
Yeah.
But we control that reality because it's in a simulation program. We could theoretically change the overall weighting between the internal model and the external world such that the neurons would prefer to do one action over another. So the way we went about doing that was we said, if the neurons, which we gave them the ability to move the paddle up and down, move the paddle to hit the ball, and it successfully hit the ball with the paddle, we would reward them or give them an incentive signal that reduced the overall information entropy of the signal. It made the world more predictable.
Yeah.
And that was through a sine wave. Because if you think about this, like, information entropy is all about how compressible your data is, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have a sine wave, it's very simple. You can write a simple formula because from one period, you can predict n number of periods going forward.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if they miss the ball, we would give them an unpredictable signal in the form of white noise, because from one period, you cannot predict any number of periods going forward.
Yeah.
So we use that as a way of actually training the neurons. And it turned out that actually worked to our massive surprise. We then decided, okay, we're going to make sure that this is actually not a once-off, and just continue to collect thousands of hours of gameplay, which resulted in our paper being published in October 22, I think, with very, very small p values. So it meant that whatever effect we were seeing could not have happened purely by chance. There must be some effect that is happening that is directed. However, one aspect that we did notice by doing this was that the performance of the neurons had quite a bit of variability. So the variance actually caused the effect size to reduce. We decided not to cherry pick any of our data, and we just published everything that we got. Such that we were able to say, fine, yes, there is a very small effect size because of the great amount of variance. And, this is new technology. We don't really have much control over it yet. But there is a significance in the difference delta that we see in the learning effect between the first 0 to 5 and the 6 to 20 minutes, thereby indicating that there must be some sort of synaptic reorganization or electrical firing pattern activity that has contributed to this ability for the neurons to, as a collective whole improve the rate of return.
Yeah. Wow. And I saw you brought DishBrain. I don't know how you got that on the plane to CogX. Yes. And it's amazing because it's like the size of a suitcase to keep these brain cells alive and connected. And I remember you said something about that, you know, in that little box you had, essentially you could bring oxygen to the brain cells, you could bring nutrients to the brain cells, etc. So can you tell me more about DishBrain?
Yeah. So what we usually, I'll find some of the nomenclature. So DishBrain is what we usually internally refer to as the chip with neurons growing on top of it.
Yeah.
The device that I bought to CogX is actually what we call the CL1. So we are naming it after generation name. So this is the first time we're building the CL device. We're already having ideas what we're going to do with CL2 and 3 subsequently, but the CL1 essentially has two main components. Firstly, it has a multi-electrode array interface, so we can actually read electrical activity and stimulate the neurons, and then we control the entire technical stack all the way up to the actual passive electrodes, so that way we know exactly the timing, how do we stimulate them, the waveforms, and so forth. So we're actually building abstraction layers right now to allow you to control all these minutiae detail, but in a very high-level programming language and what they call domain-specific language, so that you can say, I want to draw a square wave, a triphasic square wave of these sort of parameters, and I want it to happen every 20 milliseconds or so in a loop kind of thing, rather than actually coding the commands one by one in order to do that. We can say, describe it in this kind of form and send it to the machine, and it will figure out how to stimulate the neurons according to your instructions.
Yeah.
So that's the first component. The second component is an artificial life support system, because these neurons are growing outside of the body.
Yeah.
And so therefore they lack the, firstly, an immune system. So, you know, they're prone to getting infections or contamination from viruses, fungi, yeast and so forth, bacteria as well. and secondarily, because they're outside of the body, they're exposed to the elements. And neurons, particularly as with other cells, have to operate in a very tightened balance of what we call homeostasis, which for humans is 37 degrees Celsius, pH of 6.9 to 7.1, CO2 concentrations of so forth, and oxygen as well. So knowing that those are the parameters we needed to maintain, we created a system that kind of emulates all the crucial organs in the body. So the CL1 device contains the neurons in a chamber that has an inlet and an outlet. So we can pump cell culture media in that is fresh, that has nutrients, that has low waste. And then through the mixing of that with the production of waste from the neurons, an outlet is able to be pumping out the so-called dirty cell culture media that has low nutrients, high waste content, and so forth. So that goes through a closed loop. So it actually circulates back on itself. But what happens in that closed loop is that we interface them with filtration units using a semi-permeable membrane. It's a standard like Thermo Fisher snakeskin compound. But what we do is we spread out really thinly and we pump the dirty fluid in one direction in one layer. And then we pump the clean fluid in the other direction in a different layer. Yeah. And by having those two sort of move at the opposite ends through a semi-permeable membrane, we have counter-current diffusion that's happening.
Yeah.
So that as the clean fluid is going through on the outer loop, the inner loop is actually exchanging the waste content for nutrients.
Yeah.
So it's pretty much acts like a
body.
Yeah, that's like a kidney. And so we do that in one part of the loop. And then the second part of the loop, we actually also pump in media that has been conditioned with the right amount of CO2 and oxygen because we have a gas mixer. So we essentially have a pump to circulate this fluid around, which is like the heart. We have kidneys that kind of do the filtration. We have a gas exchange system like the lungs. And all of these things, you know, in a closed loop system helps keep the cells at homeostasis, at equilibrium, whilst also protecting it from the elements and also from infections.
So it's kind of like an artificial body in a way.
Exactly, yes.
And so the brain cells that you have grown on the chips are in that chamber and they're kept alive because of this CL1 body-like box. It's amazing.
Yes.
It makes me wonder, actually, before I've got loads of other questions for you that I want to ask, but it does make me wonder, do you think in the future, and I don't know how far in the future, using CL1, you could actually test drug samples on parts of the body?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we've actually started to realize here is that cells that are taken, so like say white blood cells or skin cells that are taken from patients with familial temporal lobe epilepsies. So these are gene mutations that occur and are then transformed into stem cells and from stem cells into neurons, also inherit the same mutations and therefore also show seizure-like activity on the dish. And what's also interesting is that they also respond to medications to reduce the seizure activity.
Amazing.
Yeah. So we've done an experiment, and this is actually, I think, in manuscript for peer reviewer at the moment, where we dosed it with various dosages and titrated it up, saw a dose response curve. And secondarily, not only did we see a dose response curve, we were also able to see that the neurons had started to pick up the ability to play the game Pong again. So it turns out you got to fix the seizures, then they can learn how to play. Yeah. And what's more, even more fascinating is that not all drugs had the same result with the gameplay performance. Some actually had worse gameplay than others, which we interpreted as the cognitive side effects of the drugs itself, which is, you know, often the most common reason why anyone discontinues from their medications, right? Which is the brain fog and the inability to function. So, we think that this is really interesting because potentially this could lead to an ability to think about personalized medicine, where we are not testing on you particularly as a person. We're testing on real genetic twins, but in a dish to see what the effects are and give you the results before you actually give the drug to yourself.
Yeah.
And then the second side effect as well is potentially could we use these dish brains and then CRISPR mutations in to create phenotypes that, you know, expose things like cognitive decline that could be used as an analog for, say, dementia research, right?
Yeah.
And from there, brute force our way by throwing all the compounds that we know into the neurons to see, can we A, stop the cognitive decline, and B, potentially reverse that. So we're talking about hypotheticals here, but it is actually not beyond the realms of conceivable believability, and kind of the reason why we're partnering with BitBio, who are like experts at doing these kinds of gene modifications.
It's amazing. So I was wondering, when you said that some of the brain cells were able to then, after the medication seizures, the medication to treat the seizures could do the Pong, but others found it more difficult because they had the brain fog. Maybe that means that there's also subtypes of patients with that epilepsy that the drug reacts slightly differently on, which, you know, that would be amazing because then you could really pull out which patients, which drugs are going to be most impactful for.
Exactly. Now, this is not to say it's definitive because we don't really know who the patient was because it was anonymized. So we do need to start thinking about larger studies where we are able to correlate in vitro finding with the in vivo observations.
Yeah, such huge implications for the pharma industry.
Absolutely.
So what are some of the initiatives and key projects that you're actively involved in at the moment?
That drug discovery one is you know, quite important for us. So we're continuously working on that. You know, as I mentioned, we're working on the abstraction layers for APIs to program the neurons using a domain-specified language. And particularly, we're trying to make it so that you don't need anything beyond something like Python or JavaScript to learn how to program these neurons. So that's a core focus for us. And, you know, really for us, it's about trying to get the CR1 into a product-ready state so that we can ship it to our partners at BitBio and also start building out our neural cloud system so that people around the world, and we have a ton of very excited researchers and students, to be able to use these neurons remotely. So they don't need a wet lab, and we can give them access to do experiments of their own, to have ideas that they can tinker with actual real living neurons.
It's amazing. And so I saw that you had signed up with BitBio, which is a spin-off of the University of Cambridge. And I know they provide human cells for research to experiment on. So what are you doing with them? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say specifically what cell types they're going to be using. But from my understanding is that they have identified the ability of the system that we've built to measure baselines. Right, baseline potential in vitro cognition.
Yeah.
And because they, you know, we have this baseline measure, they can start tweaking their cells by, you know, doing the gene modifications and observing how much deviation from the baseline their gene modifications are doing.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. Yeah. So I think that's what they're planning to do. I don't know which disease types they're looking at, but I think they do have a whole catalog of different conditions that they're working on.
Yeah. And also, I also read online that the CTO of Amazon has come to investigate what you're doing. So I would assume that's something to do with biological computing. What is their interest in it?
I think his interest when I asked him was, you know, he said, well, he had heard that we had trained something to learn how to do something, which is always very cool, very interesting. But secondarily, the key thing that for him was the fact that that thing did not require any amount of cooling.
Yeah.
Let alone the fact that it actually sips hardly any power. So as a data center operator, once you've bought the actual, say, hardware, like an NVIDIA H100, you have a secondary problem, which is how do you, you know, your operating expenditure costs of powering the system and cooling it, right? So that itself has a significant environmental impact because of the amount of electricity we require for these systems and also the water required in order to cool the system. Yeah. So from I think environmental and a cost perspective, this was very appealing to him, even though it's very early technology,
because
it would create a pathway to lower energy consumption systems, albeit maybe not as powerful as the ones that we have here, but maybe just good enough that we can get away with.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to how Amazon's moved into suggesting using compute units that are not x86 or you know, your typical Intel AMD chips, but going to ARM chips, which are far more energy efficient, not as powerful, but, you know, for most applications would actually serve 80% of our requirements.
That's amazing. And sustainability is such a big issue. And I get asked about that a lot with sustainability and computing and AI. And it sounds like we as humans, our brain cells seem to be more sustainable than computing in other ways. So that's got huge applications if that advances. That's amazing.
100%. I think this is the really important takeaway as well, particularly from the bioeconomy, right? Or as they call it, like synthetic biology. Because of the fact that if you think about it, biological systems operate within the laws of physics in the real world.
Mm.
What that means is that, yes, they say, you know, we don't need to make a plane flap its wings to fly like a bird, but we forget to also say to create the amount of thrust to fly a plane, we're burning extremely energy dense hydrocarbons.
Yeah.
And even today, we still have difficulty actually trying to do the same thing with, say, hydrogen or other forms of fuel.
Yeah.
Now, this is the reason why this is the case, is because in nature, you cannot consume more calories than what you can forage or hunt. And so evolution has created highly energy efficient systems, because if you just consumed more as a net debit versus credit, you can think of it that way. You would just be eliminated from the gene pool. So as an organism as a whole, we've essentially evolved so that our brain can operate within the realms of a 20 watts of capacity, because that's the amount of calories that we're able to consume.
Yeah. That's amazing. And what do you think are the biggest applications for this biocomputer application, this hybrid application?
So I think the way to think about it is it's still very early days, new technology, and it really depends on where other people take this and run with it, right? So
yeah.
I guess DeepMind started up with video games 12, 15 years ago. And along the way, people have started to look at it for like speech recognition, for language modeling and image generation and so forth as we have today.
Yeah.
I would like to think that that could be a pathway that we could take.
Mm.
Not necessarily prescribing the same route, but what I'm trying to imply here is that there may be specific properties such as low energy consumption, low data requirements that are suited for other applications that we may not have necessarily thought about.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of the things that I naturally come to mind when I think about the energy consumption benefits and the data consumption benefits from these systems is naturally things like robotics, right? Where if you think about why we don't have robots today, autonomous robots to the same level of, I guess, autonomy that we see in things like large language models, is because robots have to operate in a highly dynamic stochastic environment in real time. That we just don't have, you know, 200, 300 years of data we can just throw at it to learn and have that be reproduced in a very deterministic fashion, like a large language model. So for a robot to actually excel in the physical world, it has to operate in the same clock cycle that we are operating in. So you and I, you know, a second is ticking at the same rate. You know, this video is being fed at us at 30 frames per second. So, you know, we're getting the same amount of data at that point in time. We cannot accelerate time beyond whatever you and I are experiencing, and nor can we create multiple copies and instances of ourselves to improve the amount of data required to train artificial intelligence systems. So I think this is actually one of the core aspects, right? What are the applications that need to operate in real time that need to incorporate new data and be an online system? I think those are the applications that these wetware computers are actually going to excel in as an application. And secondarily, because they're, you know, wetware systems, they would also be good for testing drugs and
compounds. I think that's a huge one. I think for me, one of the, because I'm in pharma, the takeaway for me is that it will allow us to actually test these drugs on, you know, the CL1 or CL2, wherever you're at the point. As well as find the right subgroups of patients that the drug, see how the drugs react, so you can actually personalize the medicine really well. Is there anything else you can think of in terms of healthcare and patient outcomes that this could be useful for?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other more speculative aspects of research is the fact that, I mean, without a doubt, brain-computer interfaces are the future. It's coming. The question is when. You know, with the advances that guys at Synchron have been making, you know, that I guess Elon is, you know, pouring into Neuralink and so forth. I always say that there are many paths in the current human-computer interface space, but all roads lead to the brain. One of the limitations at the moment is that what we have with the brain-computer interfaces is that we can only read from the brain. One of the, you know, potentially ethical, that might cause ethical questions to be raised. One of the more interesting ideas is, can we actually write information directly into the brain? And I think because the brain is such a complex system, trying to figure out how to do it is going to be very difficult. So potentially a system like the CL1 or, you know, a dish brain system with a much smaller level of complexity could actually be a useful testing ground for saying, here's an idea. Can we write information in? Can we get the information back out again to come up with better ways of interfacing with brain-computer interface systems? So that's one speculative aspect. But, you know, there are other many interesting ideas. There are people like, you know, again, Professor Connor from BitBio and, you know, people like Amy Rochford who have also shown that you can grow stem cells onto flexible electrode devices to act as a bridge for mice that have, you know, amputated limbs kind of thing, thereby potentially acting as a conduit for, say, spinal cord severance and so forth. So there are many applications out there. And I think, you know, it really depends on which area that you're looking in that you could actually start applying this base platform technology to.
Yeah, that's incredible. And one weird thought that came to me is because they're human brains or human brain cells, Yes. Is there any chance, because I did this episode on robotics and consciousness that made me think about this, is there any chance that these human brain cells could ever develop consciousness about themselves and what they're doing in terms of being a cell in a dish kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it would be disingenuous for me to say no. I think it could happen.
Yeah.
The question is also, though, what is consciousness? And this is a topic that is highly divisive. Nobody can quite agree on what it actually is.
Yeah.
So as a community, we don't really have a good definition of what consciousness is. And I think this is the first step at trying to address this issue.
Mm.
What are the properties? What should we be watching for? You know, and so forth. Because unless we know what it is, we can't really say we've found it. So that's the first thing. But having said that, these are, as you said, human neurons. You know that you keep stacking them up in the right order, in the right structure, you will get a brain, and we know what the brain is capable of doing.
Yeah.
So by that chain of logic, I would say it is, yes, the case that it is possible.
Yeah.
Now, do we want to do this? I think that's a big question that needs to be asked, debated, and discussed as a society in a whole. Because I think we can actually get some very interesting and very useful applications from this system without having to create consciousness.
Yeah.
But the question is, what happens if, let's say, we do need to have some sort of semi-conscious, subconscious thing in order to get deeper into why dementia occurs or something like that? Then this is where your bioethics and, you know, the principle of double doctrine comes into play, where, you know, is it more unethical to deny exploration into the space that could potentially reduce someone's suffering versus a hypothetical, oh no, we are creating a conscious construct kind of thing. So I think this is something that, you know, we're not quite ready yet as a society to answer, but it takes time. And eventually the Overton window will move and the conversation will mature. And as we've seen with technologies like IVF, you know, it is so commonly accepted today, it's not even a big deal anymore.
Yeah, that's true. And so what's next for Cortical Labs?
So what's next for us is to finish up our APIs and battle test them to make sure that they are working to our specifications and requirements, having it out there with our early beta testers and getting feedback about whether, you know, it's fit for purpose or if there needs to be extra work to be done is going to be a core focus for us. Delivering units to Cambridge, getting feedback from them as well, because we know we're going to stuff up the first time. We've never done this before, and we don't actually really have a playbook. So, you know, we'd rather stuff up with friends who would be more tolerant of, you know, some of our stupidity along the way.
I don't think you can say that. That word and you and your team don't work together.
You know, it's sometimes, you know, you can't see the forest from the trees. And when you're so close to working on a product, there are bigger issues that some of them just slip by kind of thing. So we want to make sure that we catch those things before we ship them out to other laboratories. And also, because we're so used to it running in our laboratory, we may not necessarily understand that there are different protocols, different regimes, you know, different standards that are being applied, particularly, especially in the United States, where, you know, they have a whole different like culture as well. So, so getting it out there. And then for us also just building the cluster and getting access to researchers out there is going to be crucial. So that's, I think, what's in store for us for the remainder of the year. What happens after that, I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yes, I think I'll have to have you on again next year to see where we are. That's amazing. This has just been so fascinating. So I'm sure there'll be lots of questions from people. Most of the people listening are in pharma. So if there are any pharma companies or pharma venture arms that want to get in touch with Hon and his team, if you go to corticallabs.com, you'll be able to reach out and get in touch. Thank you so much. This is incredible. Absolutely groundbreaking work. So really, really happy to have talked to you about it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of AI for Pharma Growth. If you have received huge value from this show, or maybe this episode has highlighted how you can use AI in your company, then we would love for you to support the show by leaving us a 5-star rating. Please make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button on your podcast app now to make sure you never miss an episode.